So when you moved out in 45, was there wasn't any timber at all left in that area then?
No, the stumps were still showing up.
There was timber on our place, remember?
Our place, we had 40 acres of scattering timber on it. It had about 1,000 board feet on it of big old growth.
Then the next guy made a lot of money off that place, you know, selling timber. Or not the next guy, the guy after that. Huh? You made a lot of money selling that timber.
Well, them guys did, yeah. They, so the Lardy boys put in a little sawmill there, and they cut up a couple of settings. And then they logged that big timber off. And then they turned around and sold Pat Murphy for $10,000. And then they bought back some of the house and some 17 acres and for $6,000. And then they, Pat turns around and sells it to Baker and another guy for $55,000. And they cut all the second growth where that old burn was, why that growed up into second growth and down the creek in there and then on that scattering 40. And they just about broke even, but they said they'd make it up new timber had come up off the log off land. So I guess, and then they planted a lot of that back field all into trees again. All that hard work that we done to clearing it up where they planted it into trees.
Is that what most of the land is now, replanted up in that area?
Well, they seem to, a lot of that is self-seeding, I guess. That seemed like, well, some of that to where they re-logged some of that the center box had logged, where they went in there and re-logged some of that and replanted some of that. But they logged it too darn soon. They just got a big stump cut on the bottom, and when they got up there 30 feet high, why, they just small enough to make a 4x4. The logging all that too soon.
Well, after we moved out, we didn't move right to Cornelius. We bought another place right next to our place, south of us, Hilliger Place. We lived there for what, about 6 months? Yeah. While he fixed up the house, I mean, had a 2 bedrooms, and then we moved away from there, moved to Fellow's Place down below by the railroad track in Schofield. Yet.
No, just the opposite.
Oh, the Fellow's first and not the Hilliger's, yeah. And then from Hilliger's we moved down here.
Oh, we paid $1,250 for our 40 acres, and there's some nice timber on that. And a friend of mine I went to school with, he had a logging outfit, and he twisted my arms. He wanted me to sell that to him so he could pay off. If he didn't get a winter job, he'd lose his equipment. So I felt sorry for him. And then he had quite a bit of money borrowed, and by Joey, fell about 2/3 of the timber, and then the outfit that he had the money from, why they was destitute to get that money payment made, and so here they went and seized his timber. He didn't even get to log it, and so they went in and logged it themselves, and they just took part of the timber was in there, and they left the scattering timber. And oh, I sold about $900 worth of logs off it, and about $500 worth of wood off it. So then I turned around and sold it for $2,800.
When did Howell's Tree Farm move in there then?
Pardon?
Is it, there's a Howell Tree Farm up there now?
Oh,
Howell Tree Farm? Is Howell? That down by Worf's there?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. We don't know anything. That down by Worf's, you know, that all that place is planted to trees. When did that move in?
Well, I don't know. That must have been about 7 years ago or something like that when they moved that trailer in there and planted those trees.
I didn't even know those trees were in there.
But yeah, they cleared up quite a little land there. I didn't know they had that many trees planted in there, because that's the first time I've been in there for a long time.
Yeah. Looking back on your years at Schofield, were you, do you have any concluding remarks on the area, or living up there, or the lifestyle up there?
Oh, well, I don't know. I know one thing. I spent some real hard days up in there. I worked a little in the Sunset logging there one summer in 36, and then it was hard to get any work around there, seemed like, afterwards. And in 1939, I went working in the woods up on the Sunset Highway, and I farmed and done chores and milked cows and everything, and I don't know, I still had to go after cows when I got home, I think, or didn't know, I guess I had a cow's pasture at that time.
Sometimes I went off after myself, but not too much.
I spent some long hours, and then we had strawberries, and we hired the pickers, and Martha would look after them, and then when I'd get home from work, then I'd have to haul the strawberries to town to Banks, and sometimes I'd have to make two trips. One night I got home a little after 2, and I had to get up 3:15 to go on a hoot owl shift in the woods. And that was really kind of a short night.
Mm-hmm.
And next year I bought a bigger pickup, and that worked out a little bit better. But I had, it was, I think, 120 flats on that pickup at times, so trying to make it one.
How much we get a flat that time, remember? $1 flat?
Of course, we got, had a contract for 4.5 cents, and took one load down, got, I think it was the first load, I got 4.5 cents for it, and the second load in the evening, I got, they cut me down during the middle of the day, 0.5 cent.
4 cents for a pound of strawberries, and then we had to pay the pickers out of that. Probably 7 pounds.
I blowed up then. I was working in the woods, and I told him, I says, by Joe, I says, I got a job and I can live. I said, if you want to grow them for that price, I said, just hop to it. I says, I'm through with this berry business. War broke out and the price of berries went up, and it was up ever since.
We were talking about some of the particular incidences that happened in the town. Another thing that I heard mentioned was a big snowstorm in 1923. Is that something that you remember?
23.
Oh, 23. That's the year we came to this country.
I remember the cold one in 1919, and the water tank froze up so bad, and But the big snow that I know was after the mill went away, 1948. But I think in 1935, 34 and 35, yeah, that was up there at our place, we had 35 inches of snow. Because I remember I wrote that down someplace.
Yeah, we were married then, yeah.
In 1935, we had 35 inches of, I think it was the winter of 34 and 35.
Is that the time I walked down to Mrs. Bachmeyer to get some milk? I walked through deep snow. I thought it'd be fun walking down. I walked about 2 miles to get some milk because our car was dry. I thought it'd be fun to go walk through.
In 1948, there's a place that they call the McNew Place. That was a mile above us. And a fellow named Stanfield bought that, and he built a block building there, and he said the dogs were on top of the snow looking through the upper panes of his windows in his house, standing on top of the snow. And I guess they were just snowbound there for a while and couldn't hardly get out at all until they got a bulldozer or something in there to open the roads up. But I remember And one year we was there, while we was snowbound for a while. Only way we could get out was with a horse, and the horse couldn't hardly walk through that snow. So I waited and waited, and nobody come to open the road up. So I put a plow bolted onto the side of a sled, and then I bolted a burl stave onto the mold behind the mold board, and I plowed that snow away from the on each side, and it just piled that snow up on top of the bank there so pretty, and on both sides, and of course the horses and the sled kind of packed it down. Well, it was pushing in front of us, sled and out to the sides, and I got that road all opened up, and then it froze that night, and so I went out with a car, and while I was gone, why, here they come in there with a bulldozer and open that road up, and in high gear, and they just went like this down that road, and some places they'd take dirt and other places they'd pile it up. And if I didn't have a heck of a time of getting through that, oh gosh, you'd have to back up. And I left the car at the foot of the hill. I knew it was no use to make it up in there because it thawed out quite a little. And I left down there, and then the next morning I tried to get back up in there. Boy, I just had to back up and take runs at some of those places they piled it up to get through in there when the snow was frozen.
Before the days of the automobile and the plow, it must have been difficult to get around, get out of the city when a big snowstorm was struck.
Well, you know, it was a rule why we generally buy enough groceries for last us a week at a time, and
a week, about a month.
Well,
more than that.
Well, I was thinking before we had automobiles, the way we was talking, and all this seemed like I don't remember. Of being, seemed like down the valley, why then it'd be so much difference in the snow. We'd have a lot of snow up in there, and then you get down the valley, why you went with a sled, why you'd run into the rock road, and then the sled wouldn't work too good on them rocks. Dad had a steel bob or a steel sled and runners on, and when snow would be soft in the valley, well then it would just rip to little rocks, and the horse couldn't hardly pull us. there's quite a little difference in the elevation. So in one way, most of the time we'd travel by horseback, and if it was too bad for wheels up in the hills, and there wasn't enough snow in the valley for a sled, and they'd travel by horseback and
you used to go on horse and buggy, you know, yeah. That covered wagon, that buggy we had was a top one.
Well, you...
That was funny. Used to go to Buxton with that thing.
But I can remember there's times when people from Vernonia would come by and with a load of provisions for the winter. And then they'd get caught into a snowstorm and pull in at our place overnight. There was two places that most of them would stop. If the people in the valley there didn't have room to put them up anymore, well, then they'd send them up to our place. And this guy came there, and he left his wagon out on the main road, and he come in there with his wife and another lady and stayed all night. And then Dad let him have our sled to go home, and I think he took some of the provisions in that sled and left most of it in his wagon. And then when he come back to get his wagon away, he didn't bring our sled back. And so Dad kind of got peeved about that, so he went over there to see him why he didn't bring that sled back. Well, here he'd traveled I don't know how many miles of rock road over there. We had a brand new sled, and he said those sled runners was only about that thick left. He had them all wore out over and I guess they were about that thick of natural growth maple. And so Dad, he was a little bit burnt up about it.
I would imagine so.
The old fella told me, he said, well, you can have your sled, but he said, well, what do I want with a sled after it's all wore out?
Did the snow or the weather ever get so bad that the railroad train couldn't run?
Well, they had difficulties taking up around Cochrane. Why, my son worked on the section there for 1 year. Let's see, what year was that? Was that 48?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
Could be, yeah. He was about 20.
Or was it sooner?
No.
It must have been around 48.
Could have been much sooner.
He said it was about from 11 to 13 foot deep at Cochrane in there.
But how did railroad get through? Didn't they have plows in the
front?
Yeah,
they put two and three locomotives together to push those, push it open. And then they had to clean the track out on crossings and by hand. There was times there was no train at all for a few days.
Changing subjects somewhat here. When I was up in Schofield with you folks, there was mention of a Greek community.
Oh, yeah, there was a section gang that they used Greeks to maintain the tracks and build tracks and maintain them. And they lived up the track kind of by themselves. I guess they kind of made a camp so they wouldn't be any squabbles or anything like that, or so they'd be all for themselves, I guess, in other words. And so they fixed their camp up along the track up there. Well, it wasn't so far for them to go to work either. Then they'd be closer to their work up in the woods.
That's where the camp was. Where the depot was, up the track there, a ways from the depot?
Up the towards the Filons, or Novoskoski's, where the Greek camp was. But, there was some pretty nice sort of guys in there that worked in there. I know I used to sell a lot of veal and vegetables and different things to them. They seemed like they'd want to buy every one of my veal that I'd had. They invited me for supper one time even. That's when I was a batch in there. And he invited me in for supper to eat with them one time.
How many were there?
Oh, I think it was about a dozen, I think, or something like that. There was two men had their wives there. And it was kind of in cahoots of buying their groceries, and then they had their storage room, and by Joe, I guess they accused this other families of digging into their storage. So I come there one time, and there was about five padlocks on this hasp, and this one guy had to get the keys from all those five guys before they could put the veal into the storage room. I guess they wasn't trusting each other to steal from one another. That kind of tickled me to see him taking five padlocks off this off his hasp.
Well, were they? Did they maintain their Greek traditions of dress and eating and?
I don't know if I quite followed you.
Were they different from the rest of people then?
Well, the Greeks were quite meat eaters, especially on mutton. They were, since that was their main meat, I guess, was mutton and goat meat. And they used to even go and buy a steer, some of them, and then butcher them. And I know there was one, a Greek came clear from Timber one time to my place and wanted to buy, I think I sold him a young steer one time. And so he led it home and butchered it. Oh, they was quite on the bargain. They didn't want to pay too much, more than they had to. They'd try to chisel you for a price.
Did they dress different than the other people, or they dressed the same?
One thing I know about them, they always wore a red handkerchief around their neck. It's, I know, to keep their sun, or keep their shoulders from burning, I guess, and it was kind of a habit, and to keep the sweat, I guess, off of them. But it would seem like it was, that's one thing I noticed the difference, is they always wore a red handkerchief around their neck.
Were there quite a few other Greeks up in the woods?
No, I think there was one Greek that worked in the woods. It was the Bucking Logs. That's the only one that worked in the woods. The rest of them were just in the on the section.
Do these Greeks speak English?
Oh yes, yeah. Not all of them, but most of them could speak pretty fair.
What happened to the two Greek families then?
Well, when the mill closed down, well, then everything, they all moved out.
Well, the railroad was still there, though. If they worked on the railroad was still there.
I'm talking about the Greeks on the where Center Box, or were you referring to the SB? There was Greeks on the SB too.
There was both Greeks at the,
yeah, the
mill
SB,
and the
SB had a Greek camp right there at Schofield too, up the track. Yeah, a section foreman, and Tom Fellis, he was a Greek, and his wife lives here in Forest Grove. He married one of the girls from there at Schofield. I forgot about the SB.
They lived up the track, didn't they?
The SB had a bunch of them. One time they had a bunch of Koreans on the SB there too. And then afterwards they got this different foreman in there, and then he got a bunch of Greeks in there. But, this fellow, he had quite a reputation in keeping up his track. He had that track in pretty good shape. He was, and one thing that they was thorough about their work. Well, I guess those foremen really, to build up a good reputation, why they had to have their tracks up in good shape.
There were section crews all along the railroad then? There were section crews all along the railroad?
Oh, yeah, every so often there was a section crew. There was one at Banks, and then Schofield, and another one at Timber. And I forget now where the next one, I think it was Enright or something like that.
They were usually...
Each one had their so many miles to look after.
Each section crew is usually a different ethnic group? Foreigners, or?
Well, it's, I think the biggest part of those, well, around Banks, though, I said that was more white people. And I don't think there was any at Banks section. I think it was mostly white Americans in there, if I remember right. And there was one incident I remember. I working with a guy was hauling rock on a truck, and he was telling about he worked on the section, and they hired a young lad to saw these rails in the summertime where the rails stretch, and they throw too much curvature in the track, so they cut out a piece and to get the track back into line. And seem like some steel will stretch more than others. And so this boy, young lad, he said, "Oh, heck," he said, "my dad got a handsaw that'll beat that hacksaw to all the pieces." So the guy thought, "Well, by Joe, they'll kid him." And so, "Well, you just bring that saw tomorrow." He said, we'll find you a rail to cut." By Joe, sure enough, here he come with that saw. So they showed him where to cut a rail, and they figured that he'd never cut that rail, that he'd be there all day. And so they went up the track a ways and was fixing track, and it said, didn't take no time, or here he come with that piece of rail packing up to there. And them guys looked at dumbfounded. They couldn't believe their own eyes. That was a piece of rail that he'd cut off of that handsaw.
Is that really true?
Yeah.
Would you really believe that they could saw that with just a rail or saw? Oh my goodness.
Well, let's see, the mill closed down in 28.
Yeah.
Why did it, what happened to it? Why did it close?
Well, they had all their timber cut out. Yeah, they only had so much timber bought out, and they didn't go to work and shipping logs in like some of them did. They just decided to abandon it. And it took them some time to clean up the yards. And then when they got all the piles down where they didn't have no more carloads or could fill orders on mixed cars, why then they started selling it out to for a song. They're $5 a load. And I hauled some mighty big loads out of that mill there for my brother-in-law. I had a wagon that was made to haul ties, and I could put pipes on top of the standards. It had iron standards built onto it. And I had that, they were piled up there pretty near 3 feet high. And the first load I took out of there, and the guy said, "Well, why don't you put a load on?" I said, "Well, gosh," I said, "I don't want to be a hog." And he said, "Well, just so you don't break down here in the yard and block the alleys," he says, "we don't care how much you put on." And so by Joe, I loaded that up and went past a lumber hauler that used to haul lumber for several years, and from Manning to Forest Grove. And he says, "Ed," he says, "I haul many a load, loads of lumber, and seen a lot of loads of lumber hauled." He says, "That's the biggest damn load of lumber I ever seen in my days." And I hauled some to my place too, and gosh, there was white fir lumber there, 12 inches wide, and I know I think I hauled two or three wagon loads of that up to my place, and I brought some of it down here to Canitas when I had about 3,000 board feet that I hauled down here and then sold it. After when I moved, I didn't use it all up.
Well, what became of the Schofield area once the Standard Box and Lumber Company moved out?
Well, they just dissolved, and Cobb and Woodcock and let's see, what was it? I still can't think of that.
Wasn't third. Sisk? Sisk?
No, he was superintendent.
Oh.
I got it on the tip of my tongue, but I can't think of the third guy. That they were all from Portland. You know, I guess Cobb lived for a number of years afterwards.
Did the people in the area that were working in the mill, did they move out also then?
Oh, yeah, the pretty everybody. Well, there was one family, the name of Hamburgers, they bought a piece of ground there and lived there for a little while. And then they up and sold it and moved away, and then different ones bought pieces of ground. A fellow named Ed Booth bought the whole acreage, 4,500 acres for $1.25 an acre. And then he starts selling it out during the Depression for $20 an acre. And a lot of people couldn't get the money to finish paying on it, and then he'd have to take it back and then resell it again a number of times. And finally the county kind of got after him. County had so much delinquent taxes around and went paid up, and they kind of got after him for dealing that way with the people, and why he didn't give them more time to give it paid off. And I don't know, I guess finally he sold some of them in big patches. He sold to a fellow named Stanfield. I don't know how many acres of Stanfield bought. And then finally the timber company started buying up. And Stanfield, I don't think he even paid $20 an acre for it. I think he got that for quite a bargain. And he made pretty fair out of the timber company when they bought his holdings out.
A timber company bought the 4,500 acres then?
Well, they've got most of it by now. They've got the most of it by now.
Which timber company is this?
Home Bell has got the biggest part of it up there.
Long Bell was buying timberland during the Depression?
It was later on. No, they wouldn't seem like they wasn't buying much at that time. But later on is when they started buying. I don't know, just seemed like it was, it must have been in around in the 40s or the early 50s, I think, when the timber company started buying.
Why did you stay up there then?
Why did I stay or
yeah, why did you stay?
Oh,
after the mill closed.
Well, we had the place there in the first place, but I didn't really want to stay there after I got old enough or big enough to work out. I wanted to get out of there, but I didn't want to leave my dad alone, so I up and bought my dad's place, and then he moved to Vernonia and stayed close to my sister there. And
well, we got married in 1928, so I moved back on the farm. There we lived another 15 years up in Schofield. My folks in the meantime moved to Vernonia after the mill closed, and Dad worked in the mill over there.
Now, after my sister got married, I bached for 4 years with my dad, and he was always particular about, didn't want me to get married to some of those girls from the camp. He wanted me to get married to some of these farm girls from the valley.
Well, I was no farm girl.
And he's always getting after me. Then when my sister moved away, then he wanted me to get married in 2 weeks' time. So
you farmed your land during the time?
Yeah.
You made a living off the farm then?
Oh, yeah. It was, I don't know if it made a living or not. It was a kind of a scant living.
Yeah,
at the time we'd make something, and then in the winter time we'd run short of feed, and then we'd spend our summer's earnings to buy and feed to finish feeding the cattle through the winter time. I always try to build up a big herd and then sell them off and pay the mortgage off. And gosh, I don't know, I just seemed like didn't have the luck. I had the barns are full of cattle one winter, and just a little bit of hay, and I had 3 acres of turnips, and I was going to feed my young stock through on turnips, and some straw and hay that I bought. And here the frost come, and I only got one sled load of turnips. The frost got the whole 3 acres.
We used to raise strawberries up there too, and then we had 190 head of sheep. We had goats, cattle, and What else we raised?
Yeah, coyotes run me out of the sheep business. So. Mm. And it was only the coyotes, it was two-legged coyotes too.
Well, don't go into details.
What do you mean by two-legged coyotes?
Well, you know, people come.
Is that what you called them?
Yeah. Meat. Yeah. During depression.
We've seen one killed right by our mailbox, and I thought it was a wolf. So I grabbed my rifle and I started out there the quarter mile to the mailbox, and I got about halfway and seen this dog on the hillside, and I thought it was a wolf. So I took an aim across the stump and I was going to fire, kill that wolf. And just at that time, that dog just wheeled around like this, went behind the stump over there. And when I got up by that stump, boy, here where the grass was all rolled down, where there was a guy laying down behind the stump. He had this dog up there to sticking it on my sheep and to kill a sheep. And then he was killed it right on the road, and then he's afraid to pick it up, afraid that we was watching. I guess we went outside and seen the dog kill it. And so from there, why, by Joe, I seen tracks about every 6 or 7 feet and going around the backside of the ridge and in the ferns. And then on the road, when he hit that road, why, I never seen such a long tracks in all my days. Going down that road, that I don't know, I was going to follow him down to the mailbox, and then I hit Rock Road. I couldn't track him any further. And then I was going to, thought, well, I'm going to turn him into the sheriff. And then I got to thinking, the darn guy turned him into the sheriff, where he'd likely come up there and burn all your buildings down. So I never turned it in to the sheriff. But anyhow, I knew who it was that was doing it, and knew the dog and everything. And so then another incident, why, this same guy told me one day they was going to take some load of stuff to the Alaska Junk. And that night, our dog, we had a little white fox terrier dog, he put up a darn much fuss around there, and I figured there must be somebody around. So I didn't have no flashlight, and didn't have a shell for my .22, so I grabbed a big rifle and went out there. And this dog was looking down towards one corner of the orchard. And I said, well, by Joe, I'm going to scare somebody. So I knew just about how high that brush was, and I fired into that corner about where he was looking up through the brush. And there was that rifle, and then hollered, who's there? And at that same time, the dog started going around around the orchard. Boy, them guys went out of their tracks. You should have seen how far them tracks is. There's two guys, and that's the one that was told me they were going to take that stuff to Alaska Junk. And the next time I seen his mother, he says, what are you shooting at up there last night? I said, well, I said, if I'd have had a flashlight, I said, I could have done a little bit better. And I said, somebody's a prowl around up there. And there, I said, by Joe, I said, I ain't going to put up with any of that. And so by Joe, went on for a while. And this guy that was, I figured was there, why, he told me, he says, somebody's been prowling around my place. And so I went down and talked to old Connell about it. That was the sheriff. And he said, well, he said, you want to shoot, and then holler, who's there? So he gave it away on himself. Oh, and the other guy, every time I see him, why, it just seemed like his hair would just be standing up on his end. I think I just scared the living life out of the other guy.
Probably rather get some more meat up there.